Yeah. So just a quick summary, so that we catch up with what we are dealing with now. We've said that essentially when we're thinking in terms of the 500 years, we are connecting it with the Martin Luther putting his thesis, 95 thesis, on the door of his church. We'll come to the details in a moment. We then went from really the close of the canon right up to the 16th century, talking about the fights that took place for ascendancy to power through the Pope, the Emperor, the kings, and so on and so forth, up until the Pope won the fight and consequently humbled the king and became the top person in terms of running the Western world. We then looked at the state in which Christianity was at that time, and I hope if you were with me running down through those points, you were being disgusted step by step and wondering, was there any hope for the world? We went on to see a number of individuals who attempted to bring around those changes. There was John Huss in Bohemia, right now the Czech Republic. There was Wycliffe in England. And then we also had Savonarola, who wasn't much of a doctrinal preacher, but definitely a moralist and someone who condemned the corruption that was there. And then finally, we had Erasmus, the scholar, who managed to give the New Testament, made it more available. It wasn't not in the common language of the people. It was still in Latin and also in Greek, but he made it more available, and consequently those who were in the universities could then access it. And we ended with a statement that's been popularized across history, that Erasmus laid the egg which Martin Luther hatched. Again, the map that we looked at, we had Wycliffe there having his impact. We had John Huss there having his impact. We had Savonarola there having his impact. And finally, in the Netherlands, we had Erasmus. And by that time, the Europe was up in flames. It was no longer the Dark Ages. There was a lot of tension, political tension and ecclesiastical tension. All it needed was somebody to strike the match and everything would go up in flames. And that's when now Martin Luther comes on the scene. I want us, as we come to deal with the Reformation, it's impossible to cover the Reformation in 45 minutes, not even an hour, not even across a week. Because remember, I hope those of you who will be here in the afternoon will see, it transformed the planet forever. Almost everything you know today about life and living, if you were to go backwards from the Reformation, going backwards, you hardly would know it. It wasn't there. If you then commence with the Reformation forward, that's where everything came from. Whether you're talking about education, you're talking about democracy, whether you're talking about human rights, whether you're talking about the gospel as we know it today, whether you're talking about those Bibles that are on your laps, doesn't matter what it is. All those things were a product of what took place 500 years ago. And that's the reason why as I'll come and show in the afternoon session, a lot of people will be thinking, you know, why bother about something that happened, first of all, far away in Europe? We are here in Zambia with our own struggles. Number two, why bother with something that happened 500 years ago? We have HH in prison in Kabwe. That's what we should be talking about. Those are the kind of things that people are likely to be speaking about in terms of you reform people, you are irrelevant to what's happening. Well, what we're really doing is we're going to the source of the hope for today. That's what we're really doing. And as I said, right now we'll still look at history. When we come to discuss, we will discuss history. But when I now come to deal with the afternoon session, I'll now be dealing with 500 years of Reformation. In other words, what has now come out of this? And you'll begin seeing that we are what we are today because of this. But I'm also hoping that out of that we'll be saying the liberties we have, the privileges we have, were bought at a price. Surely, let us also pay the price for it. An obvious example is in terms of you yourselves having a sense of ownership over the church, having a sense of, we've given money, where is this money going? There must be an accounting. Our leaders must account to us in the church. That was absolutely not there. You were visitors to the church. The church comprised the priests upwards. And what you gave, you had no claim for accountability whatsoever. Everything was being done behind closed doors. Well, let's quickly then hurry on to talk about the Reformation. Now, the way I will do it is I just want to concentrate on three individuals. They were not the only individuals, by the way. For instance, I'm feeling very bad that I've skipped John Knox in Scotland, who was also a major reformer. But in view of the time I have, I really must limit myself to three individuals. And I'm almost certain that as we look at these three individuals, it will give you a sense of what was happening more broadly. And the person I want to begin with is Martin Luther himself. Martin Luther was a German monk. And as a monk, he was part of the Roman Catholic Church. As far as he was concerned, everything that was there in the Roman Catholic Church was fine. He was brought up there and in due season began to suffer from a conscience that is not at ease with the thought of one day meeting with God. And he was doing everything possible in the monastery in order to achieve this peace with God. In fact, what caused him to find himself in the monastery was his own conscience not being at peace. And one day, while going home, he was caught in a storm, a heavy rainfall with thunder and lightning, and he was sure he was going to die. And so, in the midst of that fear, he prayed to Saint Anne. Remember, they were praying to saints, to protect him. And he made the promise that if Saint Anne protected him from death, he would become a monk. And that's how, when he survived it, he then went ahead and gave himself to the monastery, much against the wishes of his parents, who had wonderful plans for his future career. Well, while he was a monk, he still could not find peace. In fact, what happened was, you know, monasteries from the outside look like places where there is holiness, you know, when you see people in their robes going like this. So he was really thinking that when he goes there, he would get one step closer to heaven. To his utter shock, he found drunkenness, corruption, sexual immorality, levity, dancing. I mean, everything that you could think about that was contrary to what he thought. However, he had promised St. Anne. And so he continued seeking perfection. In the process of fasting, he used to fast a lot. And he also used to deny himself of a lot of any other human activities. In other words, he became an ascetic. By personality, would keep away from anything that brought joy and comfort and luxury to people, and was constantly saying his prayers. He's the boss of the Augustinian monks. One day felt pity on him because he had become extremely thin and almost finished. So what he did was, in order to get his mind off thinking too much about himself and peace with God, he appointed him as a lecturer at the Wittenberg University. And in appointing him as a lecturer, while he was lecturing there, he began to lecture through the epistle of Paul to the Romans. And while he was lecturing through it, first of all, when he would read the statement, the righteousness of God, it would almost kill him, because he was understanding it as the righteousness that God demands of us, and consequently his righteous anger upon us. But as he was studying, and one of the New Testaments that he used was Erasmus's translation, for the first time, he began to understand the righteousness of God as a righteousness that God actually gives us freely. And especially that statement in Romans 1:17 that says this righteousness that is by faith from first to last, or by faith, rather from faith to faith, which really simply means by faith alone. It completely revolutionized his thinking. And that's how he came to understand justification by faith. Now, it wasn't complete even at that time, because soon after that, he was appointed to represent the Augustinian monks in Rome. And he went gladly because, again, of thinking that if he can go up that staircase of the basilica on his knees, as many others would do, by the time he would reach the top, he would be more righteous. And so he tried. Every step he would go on it, he would say the Lord's Prayer, repeat his Hail Mary, the next step on his knees, just like that, go to the top. There was no difference. In fact, it was as though he heard a voice from heaven saying, "The just shall live by faith." And he thought, now, come on, there's nothing in all this. So by the time he got back to Wittenberg, he was largely resolved that there's only one way, because he has now reached the top, so to speak, the one place that everybody thought if you got there, you would experience a jump in your spirituality. And it wasn't there. So when he got back, he was resolved now to clearly teach justification by faith. Well, what finally led to his pinning the 95 theses on his church's door was that a time came when the Pope needed to raise money for putting up his a major church building in Rome. And in order to raise that money, he decided to start selling indulgences. Now, indulgences were basically certificates where he himself signed. And his signature was basically, rather the certificate was saying that if you paid so much money, then so much of a period of your purgatory would be cancelled. So, the more you bought, depending on how big a sinner you were, the more you were assured that if you died, you would then go straight to heaven. You wouldn't go into purgatory. In fact, you could even buy more for your relatives. Not just those who are still alive, but even those who've died already and are in purgatory. If you bought, they would also, depending on how many you bought, they would also spring out of purgatory and go into heaven. And so, these certificates called indulgences were distributed to people, and these people went all over Europe selling them. Now, again, remember, there was total ignorance. So, to get a certificate from the Pope himself, from Rome, from the headquarters of the entire church, when up to now it's been your priest in that box who's been saying to you your sins are forgiven, now it's the Pope himself, his signature on this piece of paper, money flowed. Well, the guy who was sent to come and sell the same indulgences in Luther's area was a guy called Tezel, who in fact, of all the sellers of these indulgences, he seemed to have been the best guy. He had a way with words that caused people to part with a fortune. So Luther heard that he was coming, and thankfully the governor of Wittenberg blocked the guy from coming in, the way in which some prophet was blocked at the airport. So all he did was, instead of coming in, he stayed just by the border of that city. And that's where he began to sell. And literally, the entire population began going out of the city to go and buy those indulgences. And as much as Luther would try to speak to them, they wouldn't listen. And that's how he decided, look, enough is enough. I need to bring about a debate on this issue. And so he wrote down the 95 arguments as to why this is wrong. And in putting together those 95 arguments, all he wanted was a debate. Remember, it was a church at the university. It's like you are the pastor of the Protestant chapel at Unza. It was something like that. And so he's saying to other professors, guys, I'm challenging you to a debate. The problem was that he was opposing what the Pope had said. And in the excitement, remember, by this time, Europe is tense. So when people got a hold of what Luther was saying, it wasn't against the Pope, by the way, in terms of personally saying the Pope is wrong, but it was against the indulgences as a way of coming, having forgiveness. So people got a hold of that, and the printing press had just been invented. It wasn't like photocopying today. It was a lot more, a lot more primitive. They had to take every letter and put it in a kind of grid. And finally, somebody would read to make sure that all the letters are correct and so on. But once that plate was prepared, after that, it was straightforward. Because all you do is put a paper on top. You bring this thing down, it presses, the paper is gone. Next paper, press, gone, just like that. Which was a lot faster, and it was more certain in terms of duplication. Whereas, remember, prior to that, you'd be sitting in front of people who would be writing as you are dictating, and there would be a lot of human error prior to that. And of course, it took much longer. Try and imagine me dictating to you the book of Romans. I mean, we'll be here for quite some time. Whereas simply pressing and doing this and pressing and doing this, and me, I'm doing page one, this one is doing page two, this one is doing page three. By the end of the day, we've got so many copies and circulated. That's the way in which the 95 theses were circulated around Europe. 1517. By 1520, the Pope himself had received a copy delivered to him. He renounced it, obviously. He told Martin Luther to recant. Martin Luther refused to do so. Again, remember, this is a simple monk. The Pope himself is saying, can you retract what you've written? And he said no. In the end, the following year, in 1521, Martin Luther was excommunicated. And part of what happened at this time was that he was summoned by the emperor to go and answer for what he had now been teaching, because his teachings were not just being preached, but were being written. And in those things being written, they were now spreading all over Europe. So he was summoned by the emperor, and there were a lot of governors and so on that were present for that hearing in what was called the city of Worms, although it is spelled W-O-R-M-S, so it sounds like worms. But, you know, and then that event was called a diet, because it was a place where you actually went to defend your beliefs. So it's the place, the event was called the Diet of Worms. And Martin Luther, despite being told not to go there, he was naive. He assumed, look, if I get there and I'm given a chance to speak, because now there will be the political leadership and the ecclesiastical leadership will all be there, I am sure they will see that I'm correct. To his utter shock, he wasn't given much of a chance in order for him to be the one to speak. Rather, his writings were put on a table like this. He was told one or two things that he has written that are in those books, which he acknowledged was correct, and then he was told to recant, because those writings had been denounced by the Pope and he needed to renounce them as well. Well, Martin Luther, initially realizing that he had been trapped, he asked to be given time to consider that request. So he was given 24 hours, and it is said that that night he did not sleep. He prayed literally the whole night, and some of his followers who were nearby recorded something of his prayers, and they were really cries to God for his own soul, for his own safety, for courage and boldness, and so on. Finally, the following day, again, the emperor was there, with all the political leadership, all the church leadership, and they resumed the call for him. And that's when he made that historic statement that it is neither right nor safe for a man to go against his own conscience. Therefore, I cannot and will not recant. God help. The emperor stood up, banged the table, and said, this stupid little monk, and he walked out of the place. And invariably, it's like a president walking out. All the ministers also follow, the permanent secretaries follow. and Martin Luther knew he was in trouble. Thankfully, he had been promised one thing, safe passage back home. And so, although the consequence of that was excommunication, at least he was free to go. And as he was leaving, of course, they wanted to harm him, but he left. Somewhere between there and Wittenberg, in the middle of the night, masked men came out of the bushes, put a hood over him, and whisked him away. Initially, he thought it was enemies. His life has come to an end. The next time they removed the hood from him, he was actually in a castle. And he discovered it was friends that had hijacked him in the process, kidnapped him to be more precise. And therefore, for a number of years, he was hidden in this castle, under excommunication, being looked for, that if he is found, he would be killed. So while he was hidden away, he realized that there was only one way to change the situation out there, and it was to translate the Bible into German. And so for the next 11 months, Martin Luther, hidden in that castle, the Wartburg Castle, was engaged in translating the Bible. And as he would translate one book, it would be sneaked out of the castle and printed and spread over Germany. Another book just like that. And within 11 months, he had translated the entire Bible and it was out there in the German language. You can imagine the impact that was having. While both the church and the state were looking for him and couldn't find him. What happened in the process was that the Pope died. A new Pope came in, and there was a lot of political turmoil as well, and that then shifted the attention of both the church and the state from Martin Luther, as they were now trying to quell what was happening. Martin Luther himself felt he could not continue being in hiding, because part of what was causing the turmoil and lives were being lost was his own writings, because there was now what you'd call overexcitement among the people. They've realized, for instance, that these priests are fake, and so they would be burning buildings. The monuments that were there, these monuments of the Virgin Mary and so on, were being broken, and of course the police and the army were called in, and a number of people were being killed while he was in this castle. So finally, against all advice, Martin Luther went out in order to start bringing sanity to the situation that was there. And thankfully, he succeeded to quell the rebellion. And I remember one of the things, you know, these peasants were all out to destroy these statues of Mary and the saints and so on. And one of the statements he said to them, which I've never forgotten, he said, "You people, the problem is not the statues. It's the human heart. It's the heart that must change, and not pulling down these statues." And when they insisted on going ahead, he says, "Okay, so what are you going to do when you discover that they're now worshipping the sun and the moon? Are you going to go up there and bring them down?" So it's the preaching of the gospel that will change the situation, rather than this rioting which is causing so many lives to be killed. When Martin Luther back in Wittenberg now, had the opportunity to get back to his previous life. He married a nun, in fact, so threw away his monastic vows of celibacy, and raised a godly family, and so on. Just one more item before I move on to the next individual. In Martin Luther's work, he was a middleman. He did not see as clearly in terms of the changes that had to be made with respect to worship and church government and vestments and so on. So with respect to Martin Luther, the main issue that we accredit him with is justification by faith. In other words, the rediscovery of the gospel. Number two, Martin Luther never wanted to be opposed to the Pope and the Roman Catholic Church. Never. As far as was concerned, the structures were okay. It's just that there was some teaching that was wrong. When he was excommunicated and he was in that castle, for the first time, he had to process, am I really excommunicated from the church? It forced him then to read the Bible again to understand what is the church. And he came to basically realize that the church, first of all, is the body of Christ. And so, unless there is actual sin committed against Christ, you cannot be kicked out of the body of Christ. And so that liberated him from the Roman Catholic and the being under the authority of the Pope. But also, as he was now processing what the New Testament church was, he began to see that this divide that had been made between the clergy and the laity was wrong. That the Bible taught the priesthood of all believers. That all believers can know God and consequently have a stake in the church. And they ought to be involved. They're not just visitors coming to sort of watch what somebody is doing there, but that they were the church as well, etc., etc. So I could go on a little bit more about that. So he was able to redefine the church, was able to redefine, or at least to come up also with the priesthood of all believers. He died a normal death, which, praise the Lord, was the case, because he had obviously disrupted half the world. The second person I want to talk about, I'll be very quick on him, is Hugh Latimer. We are now in England, back in England where Wycliffe was. Latimer was in England. He trained at Cambridge University and in due season became an actual lecturer there, having received his master's degree in 1514 and then was ordained a priest in 1515. By that time, Reformation had begun. Okay, where the forerunners of the Reformation have been doing their job. And on one occasion, when he had his master's degree, he had an opportunity to speak to the entire university and its faculty. So what he did is he took as his topic a castigation against those that were fanning aflame Reformation fires. And he gave a very good paper, you know, when you're speaking at a university, with all the research put into it, and that therefore, you know, what the church says is right, and you know, all that the Pope has said, and it is salvation by works and faith, and so on, not by grace alone, not by faith alone, and, you know, all that. Now, as he was speaking, he was mindful because at the University of Cambridge, there was a group that used to meet together to study the scriptures. And they were the ones that were fanning aflame the Reformation. And so one of those gentlemen was actually in the congregation listening because it's at the university. And he knew him. He knew he was sitting there. So as he was speaking, he was speaking hoping this guy would understand. So when he finished presenting and was going back to his room, this same fellow followed him and said to him, I'd like to come and make a confession to you. And the gentleman said, by all means, you know, come. So he went to his room and sat down, and he began to confess. To Latimer's utter shock, the confession was actually his testimony. He was confessing how he was in sin, how he tried to use the way of religion in order for him to find peace, and how he completely failed, and how in due season through the study of the scriptures he came to see that it is salvation by grace and so on, and how out of that he trusted in Jesus alone without good works, and how he has now found peace and joy and so on. That was his confession. And with that he left. Latimer was convicted and converted on that occasion. And the whole university was shocked because coming from such a statement that he made, he now was actually preaching the exact opposite, like the Apostle Paul, and got himself into a lot of trouble. He was banned from preaching. There's a lot of detail here, and I'll need to run through it. In due season, he was banned from preaching at the university. Another bishop elsewhere gave him a license to preach. He began to preach there. Again, they didn't like what he was preaching, and in the process, he was also banned. He was summoned by the king. When he went and preached before the king at that time was very happy with what he was teaching, and consequently gave him a position as a bishop in another part of England. And he was never an administrator, and bishops were largely administrators, so he was very poor at that. He was primarily a preacher, and again, as he was preaching salvation by grace, the doctrines were beginning to spread across. The king, I need to cut this really short, needed to divorce his wife. But because he was a Roman Catholic, they were not allowed to divorce wives just like that. So what he did was he then made the Church of England to become independent of the Church of Rome so that he could now divorce his wife. So he divorced his wife and then brought in another wife. And before long, he wanted to divorce that wife also. So that now messed him up with Hugh Latimer and everybody else, because they began to preach against him. The whole situation got messed up, but thankfully in the process the king died. Another king came in who was a young man. He became king around about the age of 16 and only ruled for a very short period. And in that period of being a king, the situation became better, and so Latimer and others, Ridley, Cranmer, and so on, a number of them became preachers whose preaching changed England. Well, it wasn't long before King Edward died, and in his place came Queen Mary, and she was a devout Roman Catholic. And because she saw how England was going Protestant, she decided to reverse all that. And during that period, there was a lot of massacre of Protestants. At least 300 of them were burnt at the stake. It was during that period that Ulatima himself was summoned, and when he came, he was imprisoned together with his friends, Ridley and Cranmer. In July, Cranmer was the first one to be burnt at the stake, and then the following month, Ulatima and Ridley were also burnt. As they were going to the stake before they were tied, Latimer said to Ridley, "Don't worry. Today we're going to light such a candle that England will never be able to put it off." And it's again become a major statement right across history. Let's see if I can cover this guy in 5 minutes. I won't promise. John Calvin, born 1509. So by the time Luther was pinning his 95 theses on the door of his church, John Calvin was an 8-year-old guy, much, much younger than Luther. He was trained initially for the priesthood. Then his father got into a sharp dispute with the priest, and consequently withdrew him from there, and in the process made him to study law, which he consequently began to study. I'm just trying to find where I've put things. Yeah, so that's what he went on to study. While at university, he got into touch with the writings of the forerunners of the Reformation, the writings of individuals like Martin Luther, and also the Wycliffes and Tyndales and so on. And as he began to read and be exposed to this, he got to see the errors of the Roman Catholic Church in which he was, and consequently became a Protestant. John Calvin, by the way, was growing up in France. So I should have mentioned that, because Luther was in Germany, Latimer was in England. Now we are in the France, Switzerland area. As he was growing up there and got converted, he was roughly the age of 21 when he was converted. And from there, within 5 years, Calvin saw that there was need, because the Protestants were being persecuted, were being killed in various countries. So he thought the best way to quell this was to write down what we really believe. What is it that Protestants believe? So, as a 25-year-old guy, he began to write the Institutes of the Christian Religion, which up to today is probably the best definition of the Christian faith that we have anywhere on the planet. Now just remember, it was a young man writing it, and he wasn't writing it in the comfort of "I will get this reward." It was at the danger of his own life. Okay. At the danger of his own life. So, as he was in France, the situation became fairly dangerous. So he decided, "Let me cross over and go into Strasbourg." But to get to Strasbourg, he had to pass through Switzerland, and more specifically, he had to pass through Geneva. As he was passing through Geneva at night, hoping the following day to connect, Farrell, who was within Geneva itself and had been busy trying to transform Geneva on Protestant lines, heard that Calvin was in town. And he had already read something of Calvin's writings, and he knew the brilliant mind that Calvin had. So he sought him at night and finally found him. And he said to him, "Calvin, you better stop your journey and just stay here." Calvin refused. He said to him, "Look, I still want to continue my journey." He says, "No, I need your help to reform Geneva." Calvin says, "Look, I'm running from trouble. I'm not willing to be in any form of trouble here. I want to do research work and to write." Farrell had a bigger stature and a lot more short-tempered. He lost his temper at that point. And he threatened Calvin with the curse of God if he continued the journey. Calvin trembled to his very core. And that's how he cancelled his journey and remained in Geneva. That one act is what gave the Reformation its next phase for two reasons. First of all, Calvin now had an opportunity to begin writing commentaries of all the books of the Bible. That helped people to understand this book that had newly been placed in their hands. Calvin also was made pastor of the church, which is right in the center of Geneva. And therefore, he was preaching there regularly to the leadership of the city, and many of them became converted to the Christian faith. Calvin also began to think through a lot of issues that his predecessors did not think through. For instance, church government. All these structures, where are they in the Bible? Where? So as far as Calvin was concerned, there were only four offices that he ended up with. There was the diaconate, yes. There was also the position of elders. But he then also had two positions for those that were preachers. One position was that of a pastor, and the other position was that of a teacher. And in his own mind, the pastor was over the congregation, the teacher was over the university. That's the way he understood the structures. But all of them then were part of what would be called the presbytery. In other words, the body of elders. And that's where decisions to do with the running of the church would be done. And hence was born what is called today the Presbyterian form of church government. He had that on one side, and he also had the council that was running the city on the other. And he was busy taking from the scriptures the different stratas of social life and living, and he was then implementing them together with the council over on this end. So Geneva became the one place on the planet Earth that you could read your Bible and see it implemented. And at the center of that was Calvin. Well, you know, when you are now bringing in biblical morality into society, you are trying to force unbelievers to live Christian lives. There was a revolt. And it was instigated by a Roman Catholic priest who clearly was trying to get Geneva back into Roman Catholicism. And so a decision was made in the council that Calvin and Farrell should leave. So they were banished. And so that's how they left Geneva. And Calvin continued his journey to Strasbourg, where he became a pastor of French refugees that were running out from persecution in France. He was enjoying himself there as he was pastoring them. Well, Geneva was up in flames before long, because in giving people liberty, it went the opposite direction, and it was becoming ungovernable. That's how the leaders of Geneva said, "Where is Calvin? We need him back here." So they called for him. Knowing who Calvin was, initially he completely refuses. "No, guys, look, I'm happy enough. Look, I've got my flock, I'm serving here." They would not take no for an answer. So that's how finally Calvin went back and continued the work of reformation there. Something else that he now added was the training of pastors. And so the whole of Europe, including England, Scotland, and so on, began to send pastors, future pastors, to Geneva for training. And he had a favorite statement. He said, "Send me sticks and feathers, I'll send you arrows." And so the preachers that were being trained in Geneva were now being spread across Europe. And they were expositors of the scriptures. Now, let me tell you one thing. I use Calvin's commentaries today. Remember, this is 500 years later. And I'd like to challenge you to pick a commentary by Calvin and try and use it on any passage of scripture. You would think Calvin lives today. The depth of understanding that he had was amazing. And I mean it, amazing. His commentaries are still being printed today, and they can stand any test whatsoever. So, through Calvin, therefore, there came a more systematized nature of the Reformation. Church order was cleared. By the time he died, he had done an umpteenth edition of the institutes. They had gone from being one volume to four volumes, thick volumes. Now they've been brought together into two volumes. But you attempt to read them and you're going to see again the depth of understanding of the Christian faith. So there was the church constituted properly, there was doctrine constituted properly, there was the city, the society also constituted properly. We'll come to apply it a little later on in the afternoon when we come to the whole issue of human rights and democracy. It's been pushed a little too far. Calvin came up with the notion of the republic, which is the representative of the public. In other words, you elect leaders, they serve you for a season, and you then vote in new leaders. So you as the population, your power is in the ballot box to bring in leaders. If they fail, once their term is over, you bring in others. But while they are serving, they have actual power, and consequently they rule, and that is as representatives of the people. Up to today, by the way, Geneva is the one city-state that's just an incredible place to be. And hence, all these major organizations tend to go there to set up their headquarters. And that's 500 years later. 500 years later. The economy is robust, and they still refuse to belong to any country. They are literally a country in themselves. because of what was put in at that time. Okay, very quickly, just one more, and it's the Anabaptists. While all this was going on, there was an underground movement of Reformation, and it was later on called, they didn't call themselves, but they were later on called Anabaptists. And basically, there were two strands about them that made them stand out. One is that they believed in believer's baptism. And as a result, when people got converted, they would baptize them, which was a real insult to the churches that they were brought up in, they grew up in. And so they started calling them the rebaptizers, and hence the name Anabaptist. They were terribly persecuted. They were persecuted by both the Roman Catholic Church and the Protestants, primarily because of their belief. The Roman Catholic Church and the Protestants, up to that point, well, even up to now, believed that the church comprises believers and the children of believers. That was their position. The Anabaptists said no. The church only comprises believers. And if the children of believers are to be part of the church, it's because they themselves have believed also. There's nothing about godfathers believing on their behalf. Kulibe. And as a result of that, they were persecuted. In fact, the last picture I have under this is a drawing of some terrible death that they were undergoing. The second aspect about the Anabaptists is that they believed in the total separation between church and state. Now that was revolutionary, because up to that time it was just taken for granted that if you are in France, you are Roman Catholic. If you are in Geneva, you are Protestant. If you are in England, you are Anglican, which is Protestant, and so on. There was the connection between church and state that was tied up with who was king or queen. And it didn't matter where you were. Theoretically, there was a separation, but they were still tied together. It was the Anabaptists that continued fighting hard that national leaders, political leaders, should have nothing to do with the church. That the church should be in itself a completely parallel system, independent of the state. Now, because of the fact that Anabaptists remained a minority, it was not until much, much later that the church and state were finally divorced. At least over 100 years later. Well, brethren, that's basically, by looking at least three individuals, I've given you some idea of what was taking place. Calvin also, he married. His wife died soon after that. She gave him a son who also died soon after that. So the rest of his life, basically, he remained single. And he died out of exhaustion. He worked himself to the ground. As in the process of teaching, he ended up having blood coming out of his mouth and nose, and they laid him aside, and in due season, that's the way in which he died. But the fruit of his labors have remained with us up to today. Okay, so I will end there. Then what we'll do in the afternoon is we will then go into groups and discuss three or four issues based on the history that we've just learned. I'm deliberately keeping back the 500 years of the Reformation. In other words, from there to now, what have been the benefits? and then later on we will come and hear that. But once you've had about an hour of discussion together in groups, you will then give reports for about 30 minutes, and then we will go into the last session, and then there will be Q&A, and that's how we will end our time together. Thank you very much.